Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, I'm going to be joined by Jake Winterman, CBS Sports. Jake and I are going to talk about the SEC transfer portal. Winners, losers, in-betweeners. We will talk Florida basketball, SEC schedule, and kind of get into way too early preview mode a little bit as well. So looking forward to having Jake, sending him a invite as we speak, and going to get into all that. Looking forward to it, though. Look, the SEC just had a Final Four team for the first time in a few years with Alabama. There were certainly high-profile coaching changes with John Calipari moving to Arkansas with Mark Pope, hired over from BYU back to his alma mater, Kentucky. But, you know, I think a lot of player movement that's worth discussing and getting into. And certainly going to be interesting to talk about some of that. It's interesting to see, you know, who people think won and lost. I mean, you see anything from Florida outside of the top five in the SEC, for example, to as high as third, depending on who you look at. With if you're an on-three guy, you know, Florida has a top three transfer class. If you're a 24/7 guy, Florida just has a fifth transfer class. If you're an Evan Maya guy, the Gators are sixth. Florida, whatever they added 2 5-star transfer portal players in Elijah Barton and Ruben Chinyelu. I don't think the Gators are done. I still think there will be a young player that is added to the mix. I've talked about that at length for sure. So I think Florida is inevitably going to do that, but we will see just kind of where the Gators end up. Florida's transfer class right now, much smaller than some of the other ones that really have made, you know, names. Arkansas is interesting because certainly Sava Mirovicic and Jonas Adu are going to give Arkansas a pretty epic front court. We will see how he keeps his freshman class together. But certainly it looks like Arkansas could contend for the SEC after being kind of an also-ran in 2023-2024. So certainly could be a situation where they get a lot better. And John Calipari has kind of a second win career renaissance in Fayetteville. That certainly appears to be possible. Though I don't know necessarily it's trending that way. There's still another couple big names out there too. Chaz Lanier, the North Florida transfer, is a guy who I think very much could be Tennessee bound. I know that's an interesting one because it shows you the modern transfer portal right now. Home state kid, not recruited by Rick Barnes to begin with, goes to North Florida, becomes an electric scorer, can really score from anywhere, hit the logo three, can drive, can attack. Not Dalton Connect vibes necessarily. I don't think he's that prolific, but I do think he's the kind of guy who has all SEC ceiling in the right fit. And Rick Barnes certainly finds ways to use electric scores, as we saw with Dalton Connect. I think Chaz Lanier will be a great fit at Tennessee. I think that's where he ultimately ends up. But it's been fascinating to see John Calipari and Kentucky and Mark Pope and then Maryland, Kevin Willard, all getting in and driving the NIL price up to where now you see Tennessee – including some of their beat writers going, man, I don't know if Tennessee has the NIL for Chaz Lanier. So it's crazy, like, the way the portal works, because it seems like that was just an ideal lock of a fit. But Jake Winterman and I are going to get into a lot of that as I welcome him in. The first thing we're going to talk about, though, is, and this is fertile fodder for all the conspiracy theorists out there, that, yes, obviously the SEC offices hate the University of Florida. what better evidence is there of this latest affront to the dignity of UF, the new Ivy and the SEC, other than like giving them the worst SEC basketball schedule of all time, Jake?
You know, if you really want to go like behind the scenes here, you could say back to the post Urban Meyer football days when the SEC office planted Will Muschamp and then they planted Jim McElwain at this great university. They were just looking to take the University of Florida down, but great to see you, Neil. And yeah, I mean, I think when you look at this Florida schedule, I think the first thing that pops out is not playing Kentucky twice, and not only not playing Kentucky twice, but not getting to welcome them to the O-Dome, which of course is big extravaganza, big event. I've enjoyed it when it's late in the season too, and it feels like there's some big stakes there of teams trying to build their resume. But I think that's the main thing that jumps out to me is not getting to play Kentucky twice, getting to play Tennessee twice and getting that rivalry back on board of a home and home is definitely nice after what we saw last year, only playing them once. But the thing that sticks out to me after those 2 points is the fact that Florida's away schedule is exceedingly difficult this upcoming season. I mean, when you take a look at the teams that they're only going to play once and they're going to play them on the road, we can rip through it, but quickly going through it, you've got Alabama, Arkansas, Auburn, Kentucky, LSU, Mississippi State. From what I'm looking at, I wouldn't call any of those an absolute going into the season, clearing away lock win. You should win at LSU. You should win at Mississippi State. But again, it's still tough environments that the Gators have struggled with in the past. And obviously, LSU's talent is a little bit lower than it's been in previous seasons. And when you look at Mississippi State, at least to me, Chris Jans is not the type of coach you want to play only once and only on his home floor. That's among the worst situations you can possibly get yourselves into against Chris Jans. But I think the away schedule is going to be something that I'm taking a look at, where you're going to basically hope to go around 500 in that schedule. And if you can go 500 on the road, you're going to get some quality wins there and you're going to be able to add to your resume. But let me know if you feel the same way. I've always felt that having your more difficult games at home, I know this may sound obvious, is better for you, because if you lose those games, it doesn't take as much away from you from a resume standpoint, where most elite home games are still going to be quad one wins. So even if you lose those games, ultimately it's not going to take that much away from you, where, you know, when you play worse teams at home, there's still a chance it's a quad two, quad three loss. And you're welcoming in teams who, as much as we talk about the Florida logo and people like to make fun of, oh, does it hold as much weight? Does not hold as much weight. When you welcome these teams into the O-Dome, you're going to be getting their best every single time, unfortunately, whether it's what you think or what you don't think. It's just the reality of what happens when teams come to Gainesville. So you look at schools like Ole Miss coming in, who obviously lost some talent from last year, but it's like a team like Ole Miss just always seems to have a random great score. This year they bring in a guy like Dre Davis, who is just another guy in a long list of names who can fill it up for the Rebels. Shout out to previous guys, you know, Marshall Henderson, one of my favorites, Stephon Moody. Always seems like Ole Miss has got a guy when they're playing the Gators who can absolutely go off. Some other top tough opportunities, a team like Missouri, who was absolutely god-awful this season. If they follow that same track record again this year, which I don't think they necessarily will, because I think Dennis Gates is a pretty good coach, if they were to fall off, that could again be a quad three, quad four landmine later in your season. So I always prefer, you know, to have those tough teams coming into your home gym and having it feel like it's not a lose-lose opportunity. So I don't love this schedule, and it just feels like it's the same people who made the football schedule for this year, next year, especially for next year, who, going on a little tangent here, who said, we'll just flip it and give the Gators the same tough schedule, whatever, in football. But yeah, back to basketball. The SEC office did not do Florida any favors, Neil.
No, they really didn't. I love the Will Muschamp plant reference. I was thinking about that today because there's a video going around of a classic video of Muschamp just reaming out defenders when he was at LSU. And the caption is, "Me when a third grader scores on me in the third quarter in NCAA 25. So I was thinking about Coach Boom this morning. So I'm glad you brought up Muschamp being a University of Georgia plant, which we all know he was. And then I think we have to discuss the reality that, you know, the SEC says it's random they randomly schedule the one Kentucky Arkansas game at Rupp Arena. You know, what a wonderful coincidence that is. In addition to other signs that none of this is actually random, but I do think, so if I'm an SEC basketball fan, I'm upset that the two winningest programs this century are only playing one time, Florida and Kentucky. I'm upset that that's a 60 year that home and home goes back to before the SEC was fully integrated. If you've listened to the show, you know what I really think of any SEC title or stuff you claim prior to integration. I don't really care too much about it. I mean, that's lovely. Doesn't really matter that much to me or resonate. So they've been playing home and home with Kentucky every year since the SEC integrated in 1973. That's really unfortunate. And it's tough. I bet in their heart of hearts, there's people in the Florida athletic office that are annoyed because, you know, you're trying to build off momentum from the first exciting Florida team in several years, even though they went out in the first round prior to some of the late Mike White teams. They certainly played a more attractive style of basketball than a lot of those Mike White teams. They're probably thinking we were going to sell some tickets. Well, now Kentucky's not coming. Now Alabama's not coming, you know, and it's just hard to move the needle. Texas, I think, will sell some tickets. Oklahoma will sell some tickets, but not at the scale that the Kentuckys and the Alabamas and the Auburns of the world bring. And then to Jake's point, in addition to the fact that it looks like there could be some quad three type landmines on Florida's home schedule, you know, is it great to have a bunch of quad one opportunities on the road? Sure, but you better win some of them. And if Florida wants to compete for the SEC title, which Jake and I are going to talk about how Florida has a chance to do that, certainly with Walter Clayton likely to return, with Will Richard likely to return, now the office did them no favors because teams that are also competing for the SEC championship, in at least my mind, Florida only hosts one of them, Texas A&M. The rest of them are all road games. Alabama, Auburn, Arkansas, Kentucky, all games that Florida will have to play on the road with no return trip. I mean, realistically, I guess Tennessee is home and home. I forgot them. But I don't expect Tennessee to compete for the SEC title, spoiler alert, next year. So I think when you look at like the five teams, I think will compete. Florida plays four on the road. Only one comes to Gainesville. That's a rough blow for Todd Golden and what I think is a huge opportunity for him year three.
Yeah, no, I think this Florida team, which we'll get into, obviously has a roster that can have success this season based on what they've brought in. We'll get into the transfers and everything, but just a quick schedule note. I'm looking at these home games that they have scheduled. Neil, this looks like a lot of 6:30 SEC Network tips, man. And we know exactly what that looks like in Gainesville. I mean, I'm not taking away from Gator fans, and it's hard to get to a 6:30 game, especially if you're working, you're not in Gainesville, you're trying to get up there. If you're coming up from Orlando, it's tough. But, man, I just see a lot of 6:30 SEC Network on this schedule. And sort of what you're saying about those road games is it's fantastic to be able to go on the road. What looks like could be, I'm looking at it now, I mean, could be 6-7 times and have clear quad one opportunities. But like you're saying, quality losses only get you so far. And it's a word we hear a lot during bracketology season when everyone's looking at brackets. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to stack some of these wins. And most of your impressive wins are going to have to more or less come on the road, because I'm just going to rattle through the home schedule real quick. And we can just, I know people don't want to hear quad one, quad this, whatever, this point in the season. But Ole Miss, probably not going to be a quad game. Missouri, probably not going to be a quad one game. Oklahoma, maybe on the verge, but probably not. Texas will be. A&M probably will be. And then Vanderbilt probably won't. I mean, obviously, you're going to have Tennessee as well. And then Georgia and South Carolina coming to town, which could be toss-ups depending on what you think of them. Obviously, South Carolina coming off a good season, but it's not the same team as last year. We know what people think of Georgia and Mike White. You know, he's going to tell you they're going to come out and play fast. They're going to play an exciting style. You might not end up seeing that at the end of the day on the court. So we'll have to, see. But yeah, this is going to have to be a Florida team that is sort of going to have to be, you know, road warriors here. And when you look at how they did away in the SEC last season, obviously it started with a really tough loss to Mississippi on the heels of a loss to Kentucky, which had some people feeling down, including myself at the start of the season. Compact that with a loss to Tennessee. And, you know, obviously you have a nice one on the road in Kentucky, but there were plenty of games on the road Florida could not close out last season, whether it was a loss to Vanderbilt, whether it was a loss to South Carolina, whether it was ultimately losing that overtime game to Alabama. You know, you can get close and you can say we're putting in good performances, but ultimately, if you don't close out at least, you know, 3-4 of those quad one games on the road, you're going to put yourself in a tough position going into SEC play. So I'm really curious to see if they can turn on that, you know, that more road dog mentality this season. And I think it'll be helped by the fact that Walter Clayton now has a ton of success, had real good success in the SEC tournament, and looked good in that round of 64 game against Colorado, obviously, despite the loss. You're bringing in a guy like Elijah Martin from FAU, has a ton of tournament experience, who has experience playing in games last year for FAU, where, in all reality, there was a lot of pressure in that team last year coming off of their best program in season history, and night in, night out, getting everybody's best performance, having real expectations on the table. So I like some of the veteran talent they've brought in that I think will be able to sustain that pressure on the court. But ultimately, you know, we're going to have to see as the schedule goes on. So, yeah, SEC schedule makers not doing the Gators a lot of favor. But ultimately, and we'll talk about expectations when we reset them for Florida this season, if you're expecting Florida to be a better team than last year and you're expecting them to have more postseason success than last year and put themselves in a better position to have postseason success, you're going to have to show you're able to do it on the road here. So I think it's kind of a put up or shut up schedule for the Gators, where there's not a whole lot of wiggle room if you can't win on the road this year.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I don't know, maybe we are breaking news. I mean, I think most people, I don't know if most people know. So Florida's in the ESPN Events Invitational. That's their Feast Week event. I think the main reason it could be breaking news to some people is just because ESPN hasn't announced the field yet. But at present, you could have a rematch with Wake Forest. You could get Nevada out of John Rothstein's favorite conference, the Mountain West. You could get, I forget who the fourth team that's committed is right now, but I think it's someone from the artist formerly known as the Big 12. So the point is, like, it's not the sexiest field at present, Oklahoma State. So, like, I don't know if the Gators necessarily get the kind of Feast Week opportunity that you really hope for. Like last year, they had the quad one opportunity against Baylor. And then, of course, as the season went on, they were able to get the quad one win because Pitt figured out how to play basketball at the end of the year. And so Florida snuck into the quad one in the NIT. So they had two quad one games. Now, you would think with three games guaranteed at the ESPN Events Invitational that you'll get one. But again, not guaranteed. It really could depend on Wake Forest and what that roster ends up looking like. They'll be on Florida's side of the pod, is the understanding I have. So it looks like Florida will certainly get an opportunity to play Wake Forest if they win their first game, and that would be Florida's potential semifinal game. Is Wake on a neutral floor going to be a top 50 net game? Yeah, so like we'll see. I mean, I don't know if there's any guarantee. Florida will have to go and play Florida State in Tallahassee. That's another game that we know is on the schedule. Will FSU be a top 75 net team? So like the point being, yeah, I mean, Florida's going to need these wins. If you want Florida to move up, one way to make sure that you can make a better tournament run is to get a higher seed in the NCAA tournament. It's amazing, I know, but it really is something that the Gators should be shooting for. Was Florida unfairly seeded this year? Probably. Certainly, I think most bracket, if you look at bracketology, you look at bracket matrix, where they show you who was the most underseeded teams, the answer typically was that it was either Boise State, who ended up having to play Colorado in the first four, or it was Florida, who almost universally was a six seed and got handed a seven. And in some cases was as high as a five. I thought not a five, but certainly felt like should have been a six. Clemson, who had no reason whatsoever to be a six, of course, got the six. And we saw the run they made to the Elite Eight, having gotten that seed. So, you know, should Florida have gotten a higher seed? Maybe, but one way Florida could have gotten a higher seed is, as Jake referenced, not blowing double-digit leads at Texas A&M, at Alabama, in the various places, getting run out of the gym at Ole Miss. You know, I think these are things that Florida has to improve upon. Now, can they do that? Sure, but the SEC schedule makers, not so helpful as we sort of transition to the teams that kind of we mentioned, four of the five teams that Florida probably competes for the SEC championship against. If you want to throw Texas in, great. Then it's four of six teams that will compete for the SEC championship next year. Florida has to play on the road. And I think, you know, if you look at Evan Maya, who would be my like trusted source for how you rank transfers, transfer classes, Florida's sitting in around fourth, but they're not as good as two of the teams they'll compete for SEC titles against, one of which was Alabama. And I really think any discussion of transfer classes at this point starts with Nate Oates and just the monster that he's become in the transfer portal. Like, even if you don't think Cliff Omorui is as good as a lot of people do, it's really about grabbing that anchor to the front court that they kind of lack this year, as much as Grant Nelson will forever be loved by Alabama. Part of the problem with their defense was that.
Yeah, no, certainly. And I think Cliff is sort of back to like a Charles Bediako that an Alabama team had in previous years, where Cliff is, you know, I'm obviously a huge Florida fan, grew up a huge Florida fan, all of that. But what some other people might not know is that basically the rest of my family is from New Jersey, and Rutgers is my second love when it comes to college hoops. And after watching a lot of Cliff Omorui, I've always been impressed by the defensive side of the ball and what you can do when you plant him in the middle, whether it's in the zone, on the other team's best big man, whatever it is. He's always had that athleticism. Now, it's the offense that, outside of being a rim-running big for him, has not always been there. He's not a guy who's going to pick and pop, step out, take a shot. I know every big man wants to say, going into late in their college career when they haven't blossomed yet, they're going to find their three-point shot. And, you know, Colin Castleton's going to become a three-point shooter. Tyree Samuel's going to become a three-point shooter. Sometimes guys just play within their games, and that's totally fine. So I love what Alabama's getting at Big Cliff. He is a guy who is really, really physically dominant on the inside. I mean, he came in as a freshman already pretty built to Rutgers, but since then he has gotten toned, stronger, faster, more athletic. I think he's a guy that will be perfect to plant in the paint when you have Alabama shooting threes at will, moving the ball quickly up and down the floor. He's the type of guy who's athletic enough to get up and down the floor without getting gassed in 5-6 minutes straight of doing so. And I think he's the type of guy who can grab a ton of offensive rebounds coming off the rim on threes. And I just thought that was a great addition from them. And speaking of shooting threes, I really like what they add in Chris Youngblood from USF. I mean, when you talk about a perfect fit for Nate Oates' system, that's a guy who is going to be able to realistically take 5, 6, 7, 8 three-pointers a game in that offense. And he's capable of hitting damn near 40-50% of them, which we've seen consistently at USF. So I was personally a huge fan of those two transfers. The one guy I'm not blown away with, and I know he's younger, is Aiden Holloway. I've always found him to be extremely inconsistent, and I just don't know if he's like that Mark Sears type reliable guard for Alabama. I think it's going to be, you're going to have games where Aiden Holloway could go off for 24 points, 6-7 assists, a couple of steals, looking good out there. But with Aiden Holloway, you're also liable to have games where he's going 2-for-9 from three and basically shooting you out of it sometimes, which, obviously, with the amount of threes Alabama takes, you know, I don't know if they can shoot their way, you know, out of games just because they're going to take so many, they can shoot their way back in it. Obviously, with 3-point disparity, so we'll see. But I'm really a big fan of the Youngblood and Cliff transfers. I don't know if I'm as in on Aiden Holloway as some other people are. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on Alabama heading into this year.
Yeah, I actually just did Birmingham radio the other day, and I said, nice. I think that they can go back to the Final Four if Mark Sears comes back. And I think I would pick them to go back to the Final Four if Mark Sears comes back. I think you get into this Kelvin Sampson territory where it's like, oh, you're always a Final Four contender now. That's lovely. If he's gone, then obviously you lose a guy who we considered at FBH, considered voting for SEC Player of the Year. In fact, did, and then Fawcett talked me out of it. And so when we submitted our ballot, we voted for Kinect, and we were kind of like, and then the NCAA tournament happened, and we were kind of vindicated for saying it was close all year. Because Eric and I did think it was really close. I think, you know, you get Grant Nelson back. And then I loved Chris Youngblood. Shout out Matt Norlander, who was like, they could have him and Latrell Reitzel on the floor at the same time. And like, how do you guard that? You know, I don't know is the answer. And I think, look, if anyone can fix Aiden Holloway, it has to be Nate Oates and that offensive system where they can get him going fast, which is what he's always been really good at. But it's not like Bruce Pearl plays slow, man. So, you know, I don't know. I think his shot has just been really ragged, really. And that's a problem that's extended to his senior year of high school. I thought, you know, he's a guy who – the opposite of Alex Lloyd, who just committed to Florida, who's shot up 75 spots. Aiden Holloway is a guy who was, I think, fourth or fifth in the 24/7 top 50. And to Jake's point, like, he's always been inconsistent, and his actual ranking dropped to where he was almost not a five-star recruit when he signed with Alabama. So he's a guy who declined late in high school and then obviously struggled in conference play in particular at Alabama. But I think, look, this could be just totally a special team. It could also, you know, we will see. I think Houston Millett, who's the one guy we didn't mention from Pepperdine, is another guy who I think will be a pretty solid role player. But for me, their ceiling depends, and I guess it's the cheesiest, most obvious take, but it really does depend on whether Mark Sears comes back, because I think that's the difference between Final Four contender and like third or fourth or fifth in the SEC.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, I think Alabama is going to have plenty of opportunities to build this resume too. When you look at the teams they play twice this season, obviously Auburn home and away, then they also get Kentucky home and away, and they get Mississippi State home and away. So, you know, they're certainly going to have a chance to build that national resume and put themselves in position to be a number one, number two, number three seed and make that sort of Final Four run. But I agree with you that so much is reliant on Mark Sears in terms of, like, if you take that guy off that team and he's sort of, you know, like the engine that's running that offense, and you have to put the ball in a guy like Aiden Holloway's hands for 25, 30, 35 minutes a game and depend on a guy who you like his upside, but you don't necessarily like the production, I think it's kind of a tough spot to put yourself in, sort of referencing the point that Eric made on the last podcast where everybody expects a player, even though he's a younger player, he's only been in college for a year, everybody expects that exponential growth year after year after year from these guys. And I just think Aiden Holloway can take a step up and be a pretty good player. I just don't know if without Mark Sears, he can be a Mark Sears elite level production type guy that can lead that team to the Final Four. Because as much as I like Grant Nelson and what he's able to do, he's not going to be the type of guy bringing the ball up, creating offense off of himself. You're trying to get him those post touches where he can turn around, hit that shot, work his way to the rim, a little drop step. That's more of his type of offense than just going completely through him at the start of the play. So I worry about that team if they don't bring Sears back. But like you're saying, if they do, I mean, All-American candidate, going to be one of the best players in the country. And we know Nate Oates knows how to use him. So that's certainly not going to be an issue here. Yep. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot resting on that. And, you know, we'll have to see how it goes with Alabama this upcoming year.
Yeah, so another team with a top five. I said Florida was fourth. They're fifth on Evan Maya. I miss Missouri. So apologies to Dennis Gates for missing their transfer class, but still another top five transfer class for the man they call Portal God, Todd. But back to teams ahead of Florida, Arkansas. Look, people love to play for John Calipari. I mean, and no one seems to care that the success on the floor hasn't been there the last several years. And maybe that's unfair to Cal too. And it's the success relative to like early Cal success is a more fair way of putting it. I love two of the pieces they brought in Adu Thoreau, who just transfers with him from Kentucky, and then John L. Davis, the Conference USA, and then AAC back-to-back player of the year, who surprised everyone, didn't go to Michigan, and is going to go to the SEC and absolutely light it up, except for when he's guarded by Elijah Martin, obviously, in which case the hate will be strong and the shutdown will be awesome. I don't know. We'll see. But your thoughts on Arkansas, obviously Cal bringing in some nice freshman pieces too. I still don't know if this roster is more talented than – actually, I do know. It is not as talented as the one that he just lost in the first round with at Kentucky. But it is good.
Yeah, it certainly is good. And he's adding those veteran pieces that, like, you know, like guys like at Kentucky, who he ultimately found more success with, like the Antonio Reeves types guys, the older type guys who can come in, you can count on. That's exactly what you're getting in John L. Davis. Obviously, he's transferring a level up, you know, going from CUSA to AAC, now up to SEC. But this is a guy who we've seen against high major competition score at will, score successfully, and score efficiently. My main concern with John L. Davis, which might be a little more amplified in a pretty good defensive league in the SEC, is his decision-making at end-of-game situations has always been something that, how do I put this, has not been my favorite quality of his per se. I find that when it gets down to crunch time, it seems like he's not the same player he was the rest of the games. He gets a little bit more erratic. The shot selection isn't that great, but I think he's a great piece to lean on for one season and somebody who, you know, you can put the ball in his hands for most of the game and you're going to get that consistent scoring. And another guy you mentioned, Jonas Adu, I mean, the way that they're trying to build that front court with him and Zvonimir Visic, I think is admirable, and I think is definitely a good strategy there. Adu, obviously, you're getting an excellent defender. You're getting a guy who can attack the rim at will. It's just a real pest down there. So I've always been a huge fan of Adu. I was surprised Tennessee didn't maybe try and retain his talents a little bit more. You don't know if that's a cash thing. We know Jerry Jones and the Purdue family and everybody's pouring money into Arkansas right now. So we know if you're trying to get a couple dollars, that Arkansas and Coach Cal is definitely a good place to be. And we know Coach Cal's bags are never light when he's out there recruiting. So that's certainly never an issue. But I think this Arkansas team, I think this Arkansas team should, obviously, better than last year, what was a bit of a disaster in terms of, I thought they had some good individual talent, but it seemed like when you tried to put all the pieces together, it simply didn't work under Muss. And I think Muss probably made a good decision sort of restarting his clock and getting out to USC and sort of resetting a situation where he can say, look at all the success I had at Arkansas this one season. We can just look at it as a blemish. But I agree with you. When you look at Coach Cal's team at Kentucky last year and you look at his team at Arkansas this year, I mean, he definitely had more talent on that Kentucky team last year. This Arkansas team might be a little bit older and maybe we see, you know, a new Cal and, you know, trying to reframe how he builds his rosters and what he tries to do in the next step of his career at Arkansas. But I think Arkansas should be a pretty good team this year, but I don't know if I'd put them in that top two, top three of the SEC. I just don't know if I see enough there for that team to take a step from what they were last year. Obviously, it's almost a completely different team, so it's hard to even compare the two. But I just don't know if I see Arkansas in like that top two, top three of the SEC this season. It might take Cal another year to really do it fully his way with an entire offseason of players knowing he's the Arkansas coach, not knowing what the coaching situation is in Fayetteville. So I don't know if this is going to be the year that Arkansas takes a step back into that top three of the SEC, but they certainly could, you know. But I'm not personally seeing it. Just like when we talk about Tennessee in a little bit, that's a team I really don't see, you know, doing anything like what they did last season. So, yeah, so, you know.
Sorry about that, no, Jake.
It's okay. No,
I don't know what happened. My screen froze for those wondering why there was awkward silence there. I agree with Jake. One thing that I think, for me, I think wild cards for them are Zvonimir Visic and Adu Thoreau, the guys that transfer over from Kentucky, and maybe even Thoreau more than Big Z. I think Big Z, like, intrigues people because – that's the modern NBA big, right? Like, he's a guy that can guard five spots and he can shoot the three and look at how tall he is and he can dribble. And look, this guy is not Wimby. And I think if he were even in the same zip code as Wimby, we would have seen him playing more than 2 to 3 minutes in most SEC games. John Calipari would put him on the floor if that's what he was capable of. Yes, he had a really nice game in his SEC debut against Georgia, whose best big man was Russell Shewa, who terrorized Florida but was terrible against pretty much everybody else. And so I think, you know, we can't expect much from him. Adu Thoreau does interest me, though, because if you talk to five NBA scouts, you get five different answers, but they're always good answers. They're always like anything from healthy Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, which seems a bit of a stretch, but fair when you look at his body, to
hopefully not with the same form, you know.
Yeah, but to like, hey, this is a guy who's going to play 10 years in the NBA because he can play five spots and really guard. And so, like, I think his development and maturation matters. And like Eric Fawcett said, and you referenced Eric's comment that you can expect a jump sometimes, but not all the time. And like those big leaps are super rare. Like not everybody does what Joakim Noah did. It's very unusual. In fact, you know, even the moderate leaps like Mark Sears a year ago to Mark Sears Final Four All-American Mark Sears was somewhat surprising. So I think when you look at Arkansas, I too see a team that, wow, certainly John has done a nice job of building out that roster. I think they'll be much better than they were last year. But yeah, I mean, I told people when Muss left, like I was surprised that Muss didn't leave a year ago. Like he's never been a guy who stays a long time. He's never been a guy who's terribly interested in program building. He's always been a basketball mercenary. Even when he was in the pros, he would switch jobs quite frequently as an assistant. So I think, you know, the move to USC, while shocking to some, shouldn't have shocked anybody that's followed Muss's career. I do think Cal will be revitalized a little bit from a personal standpoint. He's going to love not having the Kentucky fans breathing down his neck all the time. I expect them to be pretty good, but I think for them, pretty good is fourth or fifth in the SEC. A team whose build I do love is Kentucky's. And if you talk to Fawcett, you know what he thinks of Mark Pope's brilliant offense that they've run at BYU. They're so hard to stop. And I love what they did, especially in the front court, where they have like this versatile defensive stopper who they are going to let Amari Williams be that. They're going to let him be the guy who plays 20 minutes and doesn't have to play 30 and just gives max effort and plays great defense. And then Andrew Carr, who I think was one of the most underrated bigs in the country, can really score. You know, I think that's such a nice combo to pair with, you know, what Mark Pope will always get out of his guards, which is production.
Yeah, and I think when you look at this Kentucky build, it's just going to be so different than the teams we've seen in the past in terms of maturity, in terms of experience. And I mean, obviously, when you talk about BYU, you're going to have maturity and experience there since you're going to have the luxury of having some 22, 23, 24-year-old players. And obviously, Mark Pope has realized when you have adults playing against 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, you can definitely give yourselves a little bit of an advantage. And he just brought in some men on the scene when you look at it. I mean, when you look at Andrew Carr, when you look at even Lamont Butler, Kirk Kreiza, Amari Williams, like Brandon Garrison, he's bringing in some big physical dudes who are capable of getting out there and competing in SEC play, which is why I love what he did this offseason. And, you know, just I know this seems like such a long time ago with them hiring Mark Pope, but I thought the reaction at first was a little weird from Kentucky fans, who I think were mad that they didn't make the splashy hire everyone was expecting. But I think once they settled in and saw what Mark Pope's vision is for this team, remembered what he did for this team as a player and what he means to Wildcats faithful as a whole, I think that hire is really showing itself to be a successful one so far, just from what you've seen from this transfer class. Another guy like Kobe Bray, who we even talked about, one of, if not the best shooters in the country, which is perfect in a Mark Pope offense where he's going to be getting plenty of open looks from those, you know, sort of drive and kick type threes. One guy I actually want to point out on this roster, because I was thinking about this point, is Kirk Kreese is a guy I feel like might have disappeared a little bit at West Virginia after coming from Arizona, where he was, you know, the big villain. When was the last time, if you can think of one, that Kentucky has had a sort of a villain type character like Kirk Kerezi, you know, that player that everybody loves to hate? That's what I'm saying. Like, I had to look back, and I guess maybe Boogie Cousins, but I don't know if at that point in so early in his career, if he was viewed as the villain back in 09, but like, I love Kentucky bringing in a real MF-er playing under Mark Pope, a guy who's going to get under everybody else's skin like that. Marshall Henderson, not with the scoring ability, but just somebody everybody is going to hate on any given night playing against Kentucky. So I'm a huge fan of this roster. You mentioned Andrew Carr. I mean, this is another guy who's going into, I think, his fifth year of college basketball, starting out at Delaware and then working his way up. A guy who's an absolute gamer out there. And then you look at Amari Williams. I mean, this is a guy that Florida wanted. This is a guy who, if he would have been down and the terms of the deal and everything would have worked out, you know, he'd be a member of Todd Golden's Gators. And it is what it is. He ends up at Kentucky. It's a great opportunity for him. But I love the way that Mark Pope has completely changed the ideology of what this team is going to be from Coach Cal teams. And I think, quite honestly, that's one of the reasons that Kentucky fans may have embraced him, is they said, look, the system we've been running hasn't gotten us a Final Four in the last 10 years. Yes, Cal is at every NBA draft show, and he's somehow in everybody's green room, and he's celebrating with every player who's been drafted. But I think Kentucky fans got sick of hearing, when asked about his successful his time and his seasons were at Kentucky, of him saying, well, we had this many first-round picks. We had this many NBA picks. I think at the end of the day, Kentucky fans just want to get back to that postseason success, no matter who's on the floor, whether it's back in the old days, you know, local kids from Kentucky coming out, you know, being the hometown hero. I just think the way that Pope has built this roster heading into the season sets him up for more early success, where we saw with a lot of Cal freshman-based teams at Kentucky, they always seem to struggle to find their footing early, and it was always sort of, are they going to lose to UNC Wilmington early in the season? What sort of landmine are they going to fall on at Kentucky? I think based on the way this roster is built, they're going to be successful from the get-go, and they're going to be physically ready. They're going to be athletically ready. They're going to be mentally ready to get into the season and sort of get Kentucky basketball onto that early winning track that we'd seen in previous years that sort of disappeared the last few years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think just changing up who you are from a mentality standpoint was a huge box that Mark Pope checks. I mean, they're a team that's going to run clinical, modern, efficient offense. And, you know, we will find out pretty quickly whether John Calipari actually tweaked his offense a ton, or he just happened to have Reed Sheppard and Rob Dillingham. I lean towards that. I don't think that's a hot take. I think that's going to be pretty interesting to me as we kind of evaluate where they are. But we know Mark Pope is going to run good stuff. We know that they're going to probably avoid those early pitfalls, which, you know, you just mentioned, which I think are we kind of had become to expect. It was like watching, it's like the people who slow down for the car wrecks on the interstate. Like whenever Kentucky played that 6:30 PM SEC network game in November, you were like, oh yeah, Wilmington, huh? Oh, they're pretty good.
Shout out to Michael Okaro, former Gator, former UNC Wilmington guy. I know he was mentioned on the last pod.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we might have to check this out. You know, let's see exactly what happens here. So this is not going to be that. It doesn't mean that they're going to be perfect. You know, I still wouldn't say that they're in that, like, Alabama, Auburn category to be a preseason SEC favorite. But – I would put them in like the Florida camp, where like there will be people who say, hey, they could win the SEC, which I think is kind of where the Gators are going to be. And I know we haven't talked much about the Gators because we actually got asked to do, a lot of you wanted kind of to break down the picture of the SEC. And I said, okay. And I think, like, so for example, Gary Parrish in the 25-1, keeping it on the CBS, has Kentucky in the top 20. And I think that's, like, totally fair. It doesn't mean, it's not a knock necessarily on their roster. It's just kind of where they're at. I mean, he's got Florida in the same spot, right? And that's not top 10-ish where Alabama and Auburn are, and Texas A&M, who we're about to talk about. But it's a team who can certainly win the league. So Buzz Williams, as close to a hot take as I get, and Fawcett knew this was coming, but told me, you know, I told him I'll save something for Jake. So my hot take on Buzz Williams is that he's not on the hot seat, but that he could become a guy under a ton of pressure. And the reason for that is when you're the preseason SEC favorite and you kind of have to back your way into an NCAA tournament bid. Now, they played a great game against Houston, and had they made the Sweet 16, nobody would have been – I wouldn't be saying this. But they didn't win that game. They lost. And that means that he still has less NCAA tournament wins than his predecessor Billy Kennedy did in his first 2 years. And he has less SEC titles than his predecessor Billy Kennedy did in his first 4 years. He does not recruit the high school ranks at a particularly high level. I think he's a great evaluator of talent, much like Golden. So where are we at on A&M? Clearly you've got a team that should compete for an SEC crown.
Yeah, so I mean, this is an A&M team that is returning four of its top five scorers from last season outside of Tyrese Boots-Radford, who I know has been one of your favorite players in the SEC over the last couple of seasons.
All-timer, baby.
But, you know, I think it falls back a lot on what we've seen with this A&M team over, you know, the last couple of seasons, where they sort of come and go as Wade Taylor goes. There's going to be games where he's capable of going out on the road, scoring 29, 30 points. And with how good defensively Texas A&M has been over the past couple of years, they can go out and win these games 67, 64 and sort of just like hunker down on defense, work off of Wade Taylor scoring. But we've also seen Wade Taylor games where he goes 4-15 from the floor and completely shoots the team out of the game, taking bad shots, and they just sort of don't generate that offense from other places. But I think one of my favorite an addition that I really like here for that team is I really like that Zirk Phelps coming over from SMU. I feel like he could be a pretty solid piece for that team. I know, again, he's another inconsistent shooter like Wade Taylor is, but hell, if you're going to build your team around one inconsistent scorer and shooter, why not bring in another one and see what he can do on any given night? You know, you sort of go back and forth between the two of who's able to generate that type of scoring on a day-to-day basis. But I could see A&M having a bit of a down year this year and maybe the seat getting a little bit warmer for Buzz. But the question I would ask you about A&M is, I know what the A&M football fan base is like. I don't know if it's sort of like some SEC schools where the basketball fan base is a little bit different, expectations are a little bit different. Are there the type of postseason success expectations at Texas A&M where you think he's on the hot seat if he's not making a second weekend, you know, winning his first round game every year? Do you think they care enough at Texas A&M to fire a guy for not having that type of success? So you do.
No, I don't. I think that's that's a good point. And it probably is the reason that it's not a hot seat situation. Because like if you look at it objectively, like I can love Buzz and I think he's a great X's and O's coach. That's not debatable, right? Like everywhere he's been, his teams execute, they play great defense, they're hard to play against, which is the ultimate compliment to a coach, right? Like because it's such a unique style of basketball that they play, but they've won one NCAA tournament game since he's been there. And it was this year. I mean, they went to the NCAA tournament and Micah Shrewsbury, who I think is one of the best young coaches in the sport. And we saw that if you're a big analytics guy, like I've heard Todd Golden is, you saw Notre Dame field a top 30 defense with like a 12 win team that had like maybe one power six talent on it. And it was the coach's kid. Anyway, we saw like they just ran A&M out of the gym in the NCAA tournament the year prior. Here's the deal for me. I think that they care about winning at home, like most SEC fan bases. So to me, like you're going to be a top 15 team again because you played Houston close, because you returned four starters, because you return a preseason SEC player of the year who ended up not being all league, not first team all league. But their home slate, talk about how the scheduling gods did Florida no favors. A&M was given LSU, Alabama, Auburn, Tennessee, Texas, and Oklahoma at home. And the only one that's home and home is Texas. Like, who does Buzz Williams need to write a thank you note to? Or, like, who has he paid off in the SEC office for that sort of gift? Like, and if you can't navigate that and be a top three SEC team with his talent, mm-hmm. like, I don't really care what your fan base is like. Like, objectively, that would be disappointing, I think.
I think one of the things that not irks me about sort of the A&M team and just their sort of style of play is, and I'm not comparing them to Virginia because it's different systems, but if you want to look from like a 30,000 feet in the sky level, you know, it's sort of the same ideas as Virginia in terms of lockdown on defense, yeah. keep the game low and slow, make it grimy, make it gross, and hope you can win a game in the 50s and 60s. My main issue with Buzz, and I mean, you can just sort of see this analytically, is like, they've locked in on defense pretty much every year under him, no matter if he's at Texas A&M, no matter yep. if he's at Virginia Tech, if he's at Marquette. I mean, even going back to, you know, I know he's at New Orleans back in the day, you know, he probably had a good defense there. I couldn't necessarily tell you that, but I think one of the things that differentiates sort of his system in Virginia and how they play is Virginia, while they might not score a lot, you know, they're always going to have guys around the arc who are consistently able to hit open threes, knock down those types of shots and give you, you know, maybe not a volume amount of threes, but a nice efficient percentage of threes going in the basket. Two things annoy me about Buzz teams is that they play this great defense, but then they get down to the other side of the floor and they just want to make it grimy as well. They're not looking to spread the floor, take three pointers and sort of stretch the defense out. And then on the defensive end, Buzz, of course, sort of like that Virginia sense, is packing the paint, doesn't want you to get good looks inside, doesn't want you to get easy layups at the rim. But historically, if you look at Buzz's teams at Texas A&M, they allow the most three-pointers of basically like any team in the country. When you look at their stats from last year in terms of like three-point percentage, or not three-point percentage allowed, but in terms of how many three-pointers you allow on a given basis, they rank 351st in the amount of threes they allowed other teams to take. When you're such an inconsistent scoring team like Texas A&M is and has been in the past with guys like Wade Taylor, I just don't think you can let a game be left up to three-point disparity where you're giving other teams three-pointers at will and sacrificing that portion of the game to keep teams out of the paint and keep teams from easy opportunities at the rim. I just don't know, as basketball evolves and as teams get, you know, more efficient around the arc and play that type of style, I don't know if just packing the paint defensively and keeping teams out of there is going to be a successful enough venture throughout the course of an entire season, especially yeah. when you never have the consistent three-point shooting that you should have if you're going to try and play that grimy style where you need a bucket, you're hitting your open looks in a low possession game. I'm not a huge fan of that style of basketball anymore, unless you're playing it at a near perfect level like teams like Virginia have done in the past. I think, like you said, with Buzz being on the hot seat, I think if he played this style at a traditional basketball school and was having the same low level of postseason success like he's having at A&M, I think he wouldn't have been run out of the building, but I think there would have been serious questions asked about Buzz's style. But I think because he's at A&M, there's no real expectations going into the season, even when they have, you know, they're one of the favorites going into the SEC in the preseason poll. I just don't think there's ever that type of pressure on him and his style of play to evolve, which is why I think A&M's kind of a perfect spot for him, because he doesn't have to be the main attraction there. The main attraction is the football. It's, you know, whatever interesting thing they got going on in College Station, which, you know, we'll leave those Aggie fans up to whatever they like to do out of Texas A&M. They're an interesting bunch, but you know, I don't love Buzz's style of play, and I just don't feel like it's evolved enough over the years. Where obviously Calipari's in a complete, or was in a different situation in Kentucky, where fans were getting mad about just using freshmen, having the same style every year, falling short in the postseason every year. I just don't know if there's that pressure on Buzz in Texas A&M and enough pressure to make him change his philosophy and try and improve his schematics on the court. I just think he's in a good spot for Buzz, to be honest, you know?
Yeah, he probably is. It's probably why he, you know, was so happy to return to his home state of Texas. And he probably figured, if I make the NCAA tournament here over and over again, they'll build a statue of me, or I can at least attain Wimp Sanderson status where, like, whoever the great coach that they actually eventually do hire wears ugly ass Buzz three-piece suits. you know, as a Buzz tribute, right? Like, seriously, Nate, like, stop with the jackets. That said, I wanted to get to Tennessee before we wrap up because you mentioned you're not as high. I'm not either. I thought,
yeah,
well, I'll like them a lot more if they get Chaz Lanier. But right now I'm in the Norlander camp, mm-hmm. not the Gary Parrish. They're a top four seed no matter what camp. Like Felix Okpara is a big who wasn't great at Ohio State and won't be great.
He's fine. SEC.
Right. Yeah. Like, he's okay. It's totally unoffensive. Inoffensive player, but not a ceiling raiser. Probably not as good as Jonas Adu, honestly, who's gone. Darlinston DeBar, he's fine. Like, cool, you could score at Hofstra. Like, you know, like, didn't they just have a guy like that who didn't contribute a ton on an Elite Eight team? Igor Milicic is probably the one who intrigues me, right? Because mm-hmm. he definitely was very good. That league that Charlotte was in was way better. And, you know, because they were, it's a CBS league, but like definitely a better league than people thought. And we saw that with South Florida being good. We saw how FAU was pushed a lot. So the AAC is good. And he was a really good player in that league, but they kind of need Chaz Lanier to Big Lebowski mm-hmm. tie the room together because otherwise, man, you're asking Zakai Ziegler to do a whole lot of stuff that Zakai Ziegler isn't really equipped to do as good as he is.
Yeah, I sort of had the same thoughts, and I know this might not be a consensus thought, and this sort of might go against the grain, but I know this is going to sound crazy. I don't know without Lanier with this current Tennessee roster if this is really a top 25 team. I mean, sort of like what you're saying, they are expecting after, you know, Don Connect is gone, Adu's gone, Triple J, Josiah Jordan-James, Vescovy, who has been there since what seems like Bruce Pearl has been there in Knoxville. Like,
he's been there since Tommy Tuberville was the head coach at Auburn.
Yes, before he was a U.S. senator. Yeah,
distinguished gentleman.
Yes, I was about to, I didn't want to say it, but, you know, you look at this roster and this Tennessee team is going to have to count on Ziegler and Gainey to, like, really take a step offensively and in terms right. of taking over this team that we have never seen them do. It goes back to Eric Fawcett's favorite point of guys don't just automatically get better and completely change their style every single year. Sometimes they just are what they are. Zakai Ziegler is one of, you know, a guard that I really enjoy watching in the SEC. I think he's a really good player. Do I think he can be the number one option on an SEC team with hopes of reaching the second weekend of the tournament? Personally, I don't feel that way. And right. I think he's going to have to be without Lanier if they don't land him. Obviously, if they land Lanier, that's a different story. You can go a little bit more through him offensively and take the load off. But you look at the transfer class like you're talking about, Felix Okpara is okay, but he also can be a foul machine. And if you're expecting him to be your starting five, like, this is a guy who can pick up 2-3 fouls like early in the first half, and you're not going to see him again until yeah. the second half. And you're going to have some real trouble there. You look at the rest of their transfer class, like Darlinson Duba, like you're talking about, he's fine. But again, I don't think he's a guy who's going to come in and start scoring 13, 14, 15 points a game in the SEC. Another guy, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing this right, Igor Milicic from Charlotte, who you talked about, is a guy who could be a nice addition for them. A guy who obviously,
yeah, I think he's a good player.
Yeah, I think he has some size and some length. My only worry about him is as his usage increased more from his freshman to his sophomore to his junior year, you saw his turnover rate tick up and up and up after each season. Again, if he is going to be your third scoring option or your fourth scoring option, or a guy you're going to put the ball in his hands and expect him to make a play, I just worry that we see this turnover rate jumping for him, and now he's yeah. jumping another level up in competition. Is he going to be able to effectively correct that as he jumps up a level, which is not what you would expect from a guy being an up transfer from that league up to the SEC?
He's also the Micah Hanlockton. You watch the film, and every team wants to get in a switch where they can attack him guy.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I appreciate that he has length, and so does Micah Hanlockton. And I appreciate that he's intelligent, so is Micah Hanlockton. It mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to matter much. Like, the reason that Charlotte was an NIT team and not an NCAA tournament team was not about their guards. It was about the fact that if you could get Igor Milicic in a switch, you could score. And, you know, Tennessee is going to keep switching everything off the ball because that's how Rick Barnes plays. Mm-hmm. So, like, teams are going to exploit him. And that's one of the ways they're going to miss Jonas Adu, is because that will then put Okpara in tough spots, right, where he's going to have to defend without fouling, which he's not excellent at. Like, I'm with you. I don't think right now it's constructed, it's a top 25 roster. I do think with Chaz Lanier, it becomes one. But I don't think it's got an SEC title ceiling. Like, I would take Florida's starting five for sure over Tennessee's. And that's what we'll close with, is my question for you, Jake Winderman. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a Wendy's Winter Sportbook. I don't need any of that yet, but I need you to answer the question of, are you concerned with Florida's depth if Zay Brown isn't the latest struck gold freshman evaluation and he can't contribute 15 minutes? Do you then say, man, Florida's starting five is really good, but after that, I'm worried?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is an element of that there. And I'm not trying to be like Mr. Doom here with Florida's team next season, because this is a team that I certainly do like. I like what they've done in the transfer portal. My main problem when I look at this Florida roster from this year and last year is I don't know that it's necessarily better than the team it was last year, or if it's necessarily, you know, on that same level, because you're losing a lot in Tyree Samuel. You're not going to have Micah Hamlockton back this year. Like, a lot of what you enjoy doing offensively and what you funnel the load through defensively is going to be fundamentally different this upcoming season. So I do worry a little bit about depth and about certain pieces, because, for example, take a guy like Denzel Aberdeen, who's expected to have a bigger role this season. He had a nice end to the year, and he played better than he did early in the season. But I don't know if Denzel Aberdeen is necessarily a guy you can play 25, 30 minutes a game consistently and get the same returns that you got in the final 6, 7, 8 games of last season when he's playing consistently, he's on a roll, he's kind of in a groove there. I don't know if you're necessarily getting that through a 30, 40 game season. So that kind of worries me. A lot of this is going to come down to, can Walter Clayton be essentially the best scoring guard in the SEC? Can you count on Walter Clayton night in, night out to get you 21, 22, 23, 24 points and be the All-American type player that you're going to need him to be if you want to replicate some of the success from last season? And a lot of that's going to fall on his lap, and a lot of that's going to fall on Elijah Martin's lap, who I think will be perfectly fine at this level. I mean, you want to talk about someone who has the build, the athleticism, the former football player that Walter Clayton Jr. was, coming onto this team, which I know you mentioned in the last pod, we're going to hear a million times about how, you know, oh, if Florida's football defense isn't playing well and their secondary doesn't look good, although they did just add Cormani McClain, why don't you put Walter Clayton Jr. in? Why don't you put Elijah Martin out there, a cornerback, because, you know, they could be helping this football team. But I struggle to look at this roster and say it's definitively better than last season. My expectation for this team heading into next year is I would like to see them make the tournament and get a win in the first round. And then if they don't advance in the second weekend, I understand, but, you know, there's still some room to be desired and some room for growth for Todd Golden. But I'm just having a tough time without them adding sort of two more pieces to this team, which they still are able to do. Depending on what those two pieces are, they definitely could put together a better roster than they had last season, depending on who they land, sort of like you were talking about. But yeah, in this current stage, even with returning Clayton, with returning Richard, and returning some, you know, obviously Condon and Haw and those and Hawk from last season, they have a good base and they have a good foundation. I just don't know if they necessarily added a player this offseason that takes them to the next level like they did last offseason with a guy like Walter Clayton and like they did with the Zion Pullen. Because my last thought on this team is that I am worried about the point guard situation for this team and the primary ball handler role. Walter Clayton, I know it was early in the season before he was fully fit into the Florida team, but when he tried to take on that role while Zion Pullen was suspended, it didn't work out great. When Zion Pullen was in foul trouble or not able to play or being subbed out and Clayton was the point guard, it simply didn't work great. Elijah Martin, a guy who can handle the ball and I love as a secondary ball handler on the floor. I don't necessarily know if you want him playing that point guard role. Denzel Aberdeen, who I mentioned before, I think he can be a solid backup to third string point guard, but I don't know if he's a guy you want the ball in his hands 20, 25 minutes a game, trying to make plays against an SEC defense and create for other players while also trying to get his own from a scoring perspective. I am quite concerned about the point guard position on this Florida team heading into next year. I think they have a lot of solid secondary, you know, off the ball handlers where if you make a play, get it in their hands, they then can make a play. I don't know if I love initiating the offense directly through Clayton, Martin, Aberdeen on a game-to-game basis. That really worries me in a league, especially a league like the SEC that's so good defensively. It seems like 15 turnovers a night waiting to happen, which is obviously a high number, but it's something that really worries me about this roster and that I really hope they consider taking a look at with those final spots that they have scholarship-wise.
Yeah, so, okay, that's interesting. And without even – Eric and I have talked a lot. People have heard my kind of views on the point guard spot and maybe having less concern than Jake, because I think they can buy committee it as long as the main part of the committee isn't Walter Clayton. Who I do think is going to be turnover prone his whole career. But I think Florida has an all-American piece in Walter Clayton. So to me, the more I look at their roster, the more I think that it's the front court where, like, they need a big jump from Alex Condon, which they should get. But, gosh, it sure would have been nice to go get Van Allen Lubin, who I think now is almost certain to go to North Carolina. Once I saw him schedule that visit for this weekend, I think it's funny because I'm not sure I know for a fact that's not what Hubert Davis wanted to do, but North Carolina did not get Cliff Amarui, so they have to go get Van Allen Lubin now, whereas Van Allen Lubin wanted to go to Florida, and mama hasn't called now multiple years in a row. So I don't know if it's the cut of his jib or the NIL price tag or the role that he wants, but whatever it is, not going to be in Gainesville. He's a kid who has been an elite rebounder in two leagues now, and who Jerry Stackhouse worked wonders with offensively. And I think Jerry, I'm sure, told Hubert Davis, hey, he's really a kid that's still getting better. And, you know, I think he'd be a good Tar Heel. And I'm sure when Jerry Stackhouse speaks, people at North Carolina listen. So there's a reason North Carolina is interested in him. I think that would have made a ton of sense because I don't think you're going to get much offensively from Ruben Chinyelu. You talk about a guy who's just a rim runner. You know, if he scores 6 points a game, I'll be very surprised. Pleasantly. You know, Sam Alexis is a guy who I think is undervalued, and I think it's a really good evaluation by Florida, and I think he's going to be very good, but he's not particularly like – he's not a scorer. He's a guy who raises your defensive efficiency rating, right? So to me, it's like, where's your front court punch? Because in the games, like, people like to point to those Alabama wins. Well, a big reason that Florida blew Alabama out twice was Tyrese Samuel could really score. And so they couldn't just gang up on Florida's guards, right? And so, like – that's going to be fascinating to me. And I guess Florida is not going to pursue a proven front court piece that can score. And whether it's NIL, whatever it is, I think that is risky. And I think to me, that kind of combined with the fact that I might be wrong about the point guard thing and Jake might be right. There are certainly concerns. I think Florida is an NCAA tournament team. Almost certainly. I think the ceiling is one that really is contingent on two questions where there's not really solid answers yet.
Yeah. And I think the offense, simply put, like we're discussing, is just going to have to come from other places. Is going to have to come from different places than it did last year. Like you mentioned, a lot of the offense was just going through Tyrese Samuel, letting him use that massive frame that he had and the real silky touch that he had for a big man, get close to the lane, lay it up, do his trademark little floater from the dotted line, and sort of get some points from there. I agree with you, and this is one point I disagree a little bit with Eric on, is that I think Alex Condon will take that step next year.
Yeah.
I think you saw from a guy who was so raw to have that level of skill and touch and footwork for a player who has been playing this sport at a highly organized level for so few years. I think you can see where that next step comes from. He's a guy who, while percentage-wise might not have shown that he is like the three-point shooter, I think he's a guy who has pick and pop potential and a guy who can sort of work his way into a shot. So I think so much more of the scoring this year is going to come from the backcourt than it did from, you know, Tyree Samuel, Micah Handlocked, and offensive rebound putbacks, who obviously I think at this point still he's expected to redshirt and isn't supposed to be playing this season. So I think your front court offense is basically going to come from a combination of Alex Condon and Thomas Hawk, who obviously plays a little bit more from the wing, attacks closeouts, can hit threes, do a little bit more of that thing. But in the front court, the offense is going to have to come from Condon, because I personally am not a huge fan of Chinelu. I want to put this nicely. I think from a skill perspective, there is a lot to be desired. And I think sort of like we saw last season, there was a reason why Kyle Smith wasn't playing him that many minutes. And obviously he is a younger player who is still growing into his game. And I love lengthwise what he brings defensively. And honestly, what a lot of Florida fans were angry about at the end of last year was the fact that Florida's defense wasn't there. They couldn't get any stops despite going down the floor. I mean, we saw it in the Colorado game, who obviously the Buffs had a loaded offense, but it seemed like even when Florida got back in their scoring ways, they could not get a stop to save their lives. I think Chinelu is a nice defensive piece and a guy you would like to have as, you know, maybe your second or third big off of the bench. Right. I think if Florida fans are expecting Chinelu to go out there, play 20 minutes a game and give you like 8, 9, 10 points on, you know, a nightly or every other game basis, I just don't think you're getting it from him. So I think realistically the backcourt and the wings are going to have to come up with more or less like 80-85% of their scoring production, because outside of Alex Condon, and if you count Thomas Hawk, who I know depending on where he plays, if it's more on the wing, sometimes he works his way inside. If you're sort of counting him in that wing group, I just don't really see where the scoring comes in the front court outside of Alex Condon, who I think is a guy who can average 10, 11, or 12. But I mean, outside of him, what are you really expecting out of the Florida front court from an offensive perspective? It's just simply not what they've put a focus into adding this offseason. They've looked obviously at Elijah Martin as a guy that's going to come in and be able to score. And they bring in Chinelu as a guy who's going to come in and be a disruptive force on defense, a guy who, you know, you can plant in a zone, put in the middle of the floor, disrupt shots, even if he's not blocking them. But yeah, there's still some that's left to be desired from an offensive standpoint in the front court. And maybe that's another spot that they're looking at and sort of adding a player like you're talking about with an Alan Lubin there, who obviously at 6'8", 230 gives you that size, can give you some scoring, do that type of stuff. But you talk about Sam Alexis a little bit there as well. I assume, would you rather have Van Allen Lubin than Sam Alexis if you're just going from a 1-versus-1 perspective?
Yeah, 1v1, I would have rather had Van Allen Lubin. But I get the idea. Like, they have the same amount of eligibility, I think. You know, I think what Florida did is intelligent, in the sense that I don't know what type of role Van Allen Lubin is curious about. Now, I know what his people tell me, but I also, I've also done this long enough now to be cynical of what I'm told by players and their reps. Right. So, you know, I think that certainly factored into Florida's evaluation. The one other quick point I'd make about Chinelu is I think Florida really needs to be innovative offensively with Chinelu, because I think he impacts Florida's spacing. And, and like, you might say, well, they had Micah Handlocked in, and he certainly impacted Florida spacing because he's just out there to get putbacks and rebounds. And I think that's true, but I think Florida did themselves a little bit of a disservice by not moving Chinelu around, or moving Handlocked in around a little bit. We saw the way that UConn utilized their kind of non-threatening offensive bigs as unique style floor spacers and pin down players. Like, Florida needs to get some innovative offensive sets when Chinelu's on the floor, particularly on a team that doesn't necessarily have much in the way of front court scoring, because Condon could be Condon, but even if Condon takes that step up that you and I both think he takes, it's just all it replaces is Samuel's production, right? So math, like, I was promised there would be no math. Who is the guy with the Condon production? Well, there isn't somebody.
There isn't somebody at the moment.
That means you have to find it somewhere else, which means you've got to get innovative, I think, and creative in the way that you use Ruben Chinyelu in the context of the offense for that to work for me. So that would be the point I'd make there. But yeah, like for like, I would have rather have had Van Allen Lubin, but I wouldn't say like it's as decisive as probably some people might, just because they haven't heard of Sam Alexis.
Of course, yeah. And I think that's fair. I just think the worry that some Florida fans will have in terms of like, if you're looking at like a second rotation that Florida might throw out there in terms of like, if you have something that looks like Denzel Aberdeen, Elijah Martin, Will Richard, Sam Alexis, and Ruben Chinyelu, I mean, listen, defensively, that lineup can probably, you know, cause some issues, cause some disruptions. But oh my God, if that lineup is not getting out in transition the other way down the floor and getting a quick basket, I don't know what the hell you do with that set of five players in the half court. And it's just when we talk about depth, those are the things that worry me because there's injuries every year. There is foul trouble every single game. And you're not always going to be in the ideal situation where you're going to be able to run out this awesome lineup where you have Clayton out there at the same time and Richard and Martin and all these guys that can score, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of extenuating factors that you're going to have to sort of consider here. That's why the depth at the moment before they make these final transfer additions in terms of whoever they bring in just kind of worries me because if that's a second unit that you're looking at and that's, you know, a lineup that gets down and isn't getting the defensive stops maybe that you're hoping for and they're trying to dig their way out of a hole, I just worry that there's not those secondary and tertiary options off the bench like Florida felt like when fully healthy they had this previous season.
Dude, that's a great point. And with that, we will bid Jake Winderman adieu. You guys know where to find Jake. He's active. He is awesome on Twitter. He has good hockey takes for a Florida Panthers fan. So, I mean, you know, make sure that you follow him and we'll have him on more frequently. Thanks, Jake. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, this is an awesome time. Can I finish this out here?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, go Gators, keep attacking closeouts.